From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz. I'm sitting in again this week while Suzette Grelot is in Italy, and welcome to Worldviews. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom monitors the right to thought, conscience, and individual expression around the world.
In some places, these laws are quite severe. Pakistan's are the worst, where it's a sentence of life imprisonment or the death penalty if you're convicted of blasphemy.
We'll hear from the agency's policy and research director, Elizabeth Cassidy, about some of their work. But first, I'll talk with Joshua Landis about the upcoming meetings on Syria, as well as the decline in oil prices and how that's affecting international markets.
$200 billion of oil and gas assets are up for sale worldwide. I mean, it is a massacre out there.
That's all coming up right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. Well, welcome again, Joshua. We got two topics I want to talk about today, oil as well as Syria. And I'm going to go ahead and start with Syria since that really is right in your wheelhouse. There are supposed to be talks next week to kind of get interested parties together to see if we can't come to some sort of resolution. There's some discussion that maybe the talks will be delayed. It's hard to tell. The big issue right now seems to be who to invite. Some disagreement between the Russians and the United States. Where are we? What can we expect out of these talks if they're going to take place at all? And what do you foresee happening here?
Well, on the 25th of January, things were lined up in Geneva to try to get peace talks off the ground. And unfortunately, as you say, it's fallen apart over who gets invited. But, you know, those squabbles are really minimal. Really, it's the Russians who've come in since September 30th on the side of Assad, and he has been making important progress on the ground. He believes that the real negotiations are going to take place on the battlefield, and he's going to win it. And
what do you mean by that?
That means that he's taken back some important towns in the north and in the south.
Assad has with Russian assistance.
With Russian assistance. You know, air power is tremendously powerful. We know that as Americans because we've been using it in the Middle East. There are 360 days of good weather every year, and it's big open space. You can see everything, and it's particularly with night vision goggles from these airplanes because every piece of metal out there in the desert glows in the nighttime. It gets heated up during the days when it's hot, and then when the temperature falls in the nighttime, it glows in this middle of it. And so you just run around looking for these things and you blow them up. And that's what's been happening out there. And it's changed the momentum of this struggle. So there's very limited incentive for Assad to go to Geneva. And America has demanded that he negotiate his own departure and his demise, in a sense. And he's not going to do it.
And Russia is going to support him.
They are. They're supporting him with this air force. And they want – they think he should win. They say, look, the best way to get rid of Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda outfit in Syria, and ISIS, is to re-empower him. And that's their strategy.
So will there be talks next week?
De Mistura, the UN guy who's supposed to be in charge of this, said, look, we can delay this for a few days, but we have to get it going. So everybody's trying to keep the momentum going, but they're delaying. Okay. Whether it will fall apart entirely or something will be salvaged, we don't know. But the underlying fact is the momentum has changed. The incentives to get to that table for Assad and the Russians are few.
So we shouldn't expect too much to come out of these meetings, even if they happen. The other issue, of course, is oil. And I think a couple months ago, many Oklahomans were happy to see oil prices dip because it meant we were paying less at the tank. But as we're seeing the consequences of that, cuts all across the board, we're really feeling it here in Oklahoma. What is the situation with oil internationally? Saudi Arabia is obviously involved, OPEC. What can we expect? What's going on here?
Well, low prices are here and, you know, below $30 a barrel. We haven't had this kind of low prices since the 1990s. It is a massacre out there. And if we survey what the impact has been, more than 100,000 jobs are already gone. Most of them were lost last year.
You're talking about in the United States?
In the United States. The number of shale rigs in service has collapsed by 60%. Banks are worried about their oil loans. Shale states are readjusting budgets for shortfalls. We don't need to hear about that in Oklahoma. After $200 billion of oil and gas assets are up for sale worldwide. I mean, it is a massacre out there. But the real question is this going to be like the 1980s with the savings and loan debacle? Saudi Arabia at that time increased production, causing a fall in prices. And it devastated Texas and Oklahoma. But this time is different. Saudi Arabia is not going to be able to devastate American industry. Oilmen say that they can produce the shale at $40 a barrel or below, and that their industry has so modernized that they're going to be able to turn the switch back on. And that means that Saudi Arabia is up against a very different environment, and it's more likely that Saudi Arabia will be brought to its knees rather than oil industry around the world.
Well, very interesting. We'll see if that happens, of course. And thank you again for your insights, Joshua.
Pleasure.
Thank you. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation. If you have any questions or comments for me or Joshua, you can leave them on our website, kgou.org. We're also on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU, and at Joshua_Landis. This entire episode is available online at kgou.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast in iTunes. After a short break, we'll hear Suzette Grelot's conversation with Elizabeth Cassidy. She's the Policy and Research Director for the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. Our guest today is Elizabeth Cassidy. Since 2007, she's worked with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, or USCIRF. She's responsible for United Nations International and Comparative Constitutional Law and oversees the agency's annual report process. She's also worked with the non-governmental organization UN Watch and spent time as a legal consultant to several human rights NGOs in Namibia. She spoke with our regular host, Suzette Grelot.
Elizabeth Cassidy, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Elizabeth, you work at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, USCIRF. So tell us a little bit about that and the international religious freedom issues that you deal with.
Sure. Happy to do that. So USCIRF is a U.S. government advisory body that was created in the late 1990s by Congress in something called the International Religious Freedom Act. IRFA is how the statute, IRFA, has now become known. And so our mandate is to monitor religious freedom conditions overseas and make policy recommendations to the U.S. government. But we're advisory, so we don't speak for the administration. We speak for ourselves.
So the Religious Freedom Act that was created in the 1990s, what prompted that? Because we think of this country being very focused on religious freedom for many, many years. So what happened then?
Well, what prompted it was a focus on what was happening on religious freedom internationally. So the focus of the act is for the U.S. to promote religious freedom internationally and condemn religious freedom violations in other countries. And what really prompted it in the 90s was a lot of the violations that were going on overseas at that time, especially in places like China and Sudan. And so it really started as a grassroots movement with concern from different civil society groups and in large part Christian groups that were very concerned about the persecution of Christians.
But you also focus on blasphemy laws and other types of ways in which religious freedom is constrained?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the law looks tells us to look at what governments are doing or not doing. So basically government perpetration or toleration of religious freedom violations. And one of the main governmental violations that we see, or in many countries, one of the main government violations is through blasphemy laws. Countries where they have laws on the books that say that insulting religion or contradicting certain religious principles is a criminal offense. And in some places, these laws
laws are quite severe. Pakistan's are the worst, where it's a sentence of life imprisonment or the death penalty if you're convicted of blasphemy. And currently, Yusuf is aware of nearly 40 people in prison in Pakistan, either life sentences or under the death sentence.
Well, I was going to ask you if you could give us some specific cases of problematic cases of where religious freedom isn't well respected. Pakistan, obviously, in this example, but where are some others? I kind of can think of some examples in my head that tell us.
And probably a number of them are the ones you would think of. So there's this category in the Act called countries of particular concern for the worst violators, and the U.S. government is supposed to designate countries that meet this standard every year. And so right now there are nine that the U.S. has designated, most recently in 2014, and a lot of them are the ones you would expect. I mean, countries like China, Burma, Saudi Arabia, North Korea, Iran, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Sudan. So those are the sort of the official – I think that was nine that I rattled through. Those are sort of the officially designated ones. There are others that my commission thinks meet that standard. But, essentially they're probably – I mean, we in our report, we tend to focus on the countries with the worst problems. We usually report on about 30 countries each year. Oftentimes you can see some patterns. So one type of example is authoritarian governments who are just sort of trying to control every aspect of their citizens' lives, including religious practice. So that would be your Eritrea, your China, North Korea, countries like that. Another common pattern of violations is where the country has a theocratic government, so they're enforcing a religion or an interpretation of a religion. And so that leads to religious freedom violations against people either who aren't of that religion or who, for whatever reason, are from a minority sect of that religion or disagree with certain premises. And then you can also get violations arising where you have countries where even if they're not officially a religious state, their laws favor certain religious groups over others.
Our guest is Elizabeth Cassidy with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. She'll go into more specific examples, plus discuss the complex relationship the U.S. has with Saudi Arabia after a short break. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. We've been hearing from Elizabeth Cassidy, who's the Policy and Research Director at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. When we left off, she described several nations the agency designates countries of particular concern for violations of religious freedom. She's been speaking with our regular host, Suzette Gerlot.
So just out of curiosity, where might something like European laws that, let's say, prevent one wearing the hijab or something like that? I mean, because you obviously didn't list, and we don't necessarily think of Western Europe or Western countries when we think of a lack of religious freedom. But this kind of growing pressure, particularly in places where you see a lot of refugees and migrants bringing, religions from other parts of the world, and there being some real difficulties between those populations and governments trying to be responsive to that. Where does that fit in?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the Western European countries, there has not ever been one that's met this so-called CPC standard, country of particular concern standard, because that really looks to egregious violations like putting people in jail, torturing people, things like that. But just because a country doesn't meet that really bad standard doesn't mean that there might not be other religious freedom issues. And so certainly Western Europe, there are concerns. And the State Department, the U.S. State Department, as part of this act that created also my commission, they do an annual report every year on all countries on religious freedom issues. And so in the Western Europe country chapters, they would talk about all those things. So those are, there are religious freedom issues. I mean, it's under the international provisions on religious freedom, it's clear that religious freedom includes more than just sort of being able to go to your place of worship and have your church service or your mosque prayers or whatever they may be. It does include the ability to show your religious affiliation and beliefs in public, which would include wearing religious dress. So, under this interpretation, either being told that you have to wear religious dress or being told that you can't would both be a religious freedom issue, right? If it's about individual religious freedom, women in Saudi Arabia should have the right to choose not to fully cover themselves, just as women in France should be able to wear a headscarf, which right now they can't do in schools. And actually, they now in France can't wear the full face veil anywhere in public.
So what can you do about this? I mean, what is it that you do? You say you provide advice to the U.S. government, but what are the options, the policy options, the tools? You know, and you mentioned Saudi Arabia in particular. Saudi Arabia, they're a strong ally of ours. I mean, you go through this whole list that you mentioned. I mean, none of those are really strong allies of ours, but Saudi Arabia is. And so what kind of things can we even do to try to promote religious freedom in a country like Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, there are a bunch of tools, and the International Religious Freedom Act has a long list of possible actions that it thinks the U.S. should take in various situations, either with violations of religious freedom or these more severe, what are called particularly severe violations. And so, you know, the U.S. government has a lot of tools at its disposal in its relationship with any country, everything from, sort of just discussing these issues in your interactions with foreign officials. And there's lots of time the U.S. spends thinking about that, you know, what issues are going to be raised, who's going to raise them, especially when you get to the level of, you know, the president is going to have a meeting with the king of Saudi Arabia and what are the issues that are going to be raised. But, you know, U.S. and Saudi officials are talking with each other at all different levels of relationship. But then also keep in mind, you know, there are different exchanges and programs and things that the U.S. government can do that can promote religious freedom. There then are more sort of harsher actions that the U.S. can take. I mean, one of them is just the designation. I mean, no country likes to be publicly put on a list by another country that says we view you as a severe religious freedom violator. And so that does get a lot of countries' attention. And the fact of Saudi Arabia, when they were put on that list in 2004, the U.S. negotiated with them what's called a confirmation of policies, where the Saudi government agreed that it was going to take certain steps to try to improve the religious freedom situation in the country. And the U.S. has done that in some other instances, Vietnam, for example, which was designated as a CPC at one point. So the U.S. does have some ability to influence things. In the case of Saudi, it had to do with the Saudis agreeing that they were going to rein in the religious police in terms of their the raids that they had been conducting on private worship. In Saudi Arabia, there's no places of worship of non-Muslim faith. So if you're a Christian expatriate worker there, there's no church that you can go to. So Christian expatriate workers worship in homes. You know, sometimes this is allowed to go on, but other times the police find out about it and they come and raid. And so there was an agreement to sort of step back from that and, you know, sort of let this go on. And there were other agreements about reining in the religious police and sort of putting some more oversight over them, and then also some agreements relating to making some changes in textbooks. So there are things that the U.S. can influence. But in a lot of these countries, especially the most severe, these restrictions are really entrenched in their entire legal and governing systems. So, changing that whole thing is not going to happen right away or anytime soon. But so the U.S. is sort of having to look at, you know, what can we do? In the case of Vietnam, for example, it was negotiating releasing some prisoners and making some changes in their laws that govern the registration of religious organizations. So you're looking for the improvements that you can realistically have made.
Well, I was going to ask about the connection between this issue, religious freedom, and other issues such as just good governance, you know, having solid governmental practices and institutions that protect a whole range of things,
yeah,
like freedom of the press and other types of civil liberties that we, of course, hold very, very dear in this country. So I would imagine this is just kind of one part of that, but highly affected by these other issues. So I would imagine you probably work very closely with other agencies and other organizations like yours that perhaps focus on those other aspects as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. These things are all tied together. I mean, both in the sense that religious freedom is part they're a whole group of rights that sort of go together, essentially. I mean, you know, you're not going to have full religious freedom unless it's a society that also protects freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, unless you have some kind of a credible judicial system where if there are attacks against people based on their religion or crimes against people by their religion, there's a legal process, a fair legal process to, you know, prosecute people who are violating law. All of those things are tied together. And you can see it on the converse side when you look at the countries that have the worst problems. They're also the same countries that sort of show up on all the other
lists of human of the worst human rights violators. I mean, if you look at the U.S.'s religious freedom list and then you look at the countries that are in the worst category on Freedom House's Freedom in the World and on the indexes of press freedom and Transparency International, the indexes of corruption and government transparency and all of that, these things are all tied together.
They're all in the same categories now, in the same groups. Well, so lastly then, Elizabeth, how optimistic are you? I mean, have you seen a lot of positive changes along these lines? I mean, because those of us perhaps who don't study this issue and are just kind of watching the news and seeing that there's a lot of religious strife out there. There's a lot of concern about tolerance and treatment of peoples because of their religious beliefs. I mean, should we be optimistic about it? Are you seeing positive moves in the right direction?
Yeah, I think there are some things to be optimistic about. I mean, like you say, some days it's hard to be optimistic. I think a lot of what gets covered in the news is the bad news, the worst stuff, the violence, and there certainly is way too much of that going around and in the news these days. So, you know, the bad news tends to get covered. There's not so much coverage of the good things that are going on in places. And one of the great things about our job is when we get to travel to some of these countries and meet with government officials and religious leaders and civil society activists and all kinds of people in various countries. And especially in meeting with religious communities and civil society activists, you really learn how many people there are in different countries working themselves on these issues, and not only on the human rights aspects of the issues, but also on the sort of interfaith tolerance and engagement aspects of the issues. And I think a lot of that is where real good change is going on. It just doesn't tend to make, you know, the top story on CNN or the sort of front pages of the U.S. papers. But it does give one hope there. And one other thing that's been really reassuring in especially in the past sort of 5 or so years is more and more countries. The U.S. was very early in this trend of focusing on international religious freedom in its human rights policy and its foreign policy. I mean, the International Religious Freedom Act was 1998 and still is the only sort of law in any country that addresses these issues. But more and more countries have come to realize the importance of religious freedom and how it relates to a lot of these other rights and these societal goods of when you look at countries, how, you know, when you have a country with these really severe religious freedom violations, you also tend to see that these are unstable. They're countries that are producing, you know, extremism and refugee flows and all of these things, and how this is all tied together. And people are sort of starting to realize, wow, you know, this is one thing we really need to improve. So more and more countries have gotten engaged on these issues, and there's a growing movement of both governments sort of consulting with each other and working together, and also parliamentarians. And I was just at a conference in New York a couple weekends ago that was the second meeting of a new coalition, an international coalition of parliamentarians interested in freedom of religion or belief from all over the world. There were 100 parliamentarians from about 50 countries. So I think that's really a hopeful sign.
Well, that's great. That's good to end on a positive note. Thank you so much, Elizabeth,
sure,
for being here today and telling us a little something about religious freedom. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Suzette Gralat's conversation with Elizabeth Cassidy, the Policy and Research Director at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. There's more information about USERF's work on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. The show is produced by Sam Dupre, with oversight from Brian Hartzinski, who also prepares our digital content. For Joshua Landis and Suzette Gralat, I'm Rebecca Cruz.